You know that feeling, right? That very specific sinking feeling when you're getting ready for a big deployment.
Oh, yeah.
You've got the budget approved, you have the software keys, you've blocked out the entire weekend to get it all running, and then bam,
Yeah.
you just hit a wall.
It's a cryptic error message halfway through the progress bar.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or worse, it actually installs, but the performance is so sluggish. It's just, well, it's unusable.
It's the digital equivalent of buying some high-end appliance. You wrestle it into the kitchen, and then you realize your house isn't even wired for the voltage it needs.
That is the perfect analogy. And honestly, it's rarely the software's fault. It's usually us skipping the fine print. So today we're doing a deep dive into system and application installation prerequisites and methods. And look, I know that title sounds like the syllabus for a class you'd definitely sleep through.
Right.
But this is actually the pre-flight check that prevents those digital disasters we're talking about.
It really is. And we're gonna move past the basics. We know you know how to click next.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about the whole ecosystem.
Yeah.
We're looking at why minimum specs are, basically a trap.
Okay.
And the architectural headaches of modern Windows deployments, and why just copying an ISO to a USB drive doesn't work the way it used to.
So our mission here is to look at the installation process not just as a task, but as a compatibility puzzle, a puzzle between hardware, the OS, and the network.
That's it.
So let's start at the foundation. The source material lays out this four-step ritual: compatibility, options, method, and preparation. But the very first hurdle is the hardware compatibility list, the HCL.
The HCL is it's fascinating because of how that responsibility has shifted over the last decade or so. Well, back in the, the Windows XP or Windows 7 days, Microsoft published these massive definitive lists. If you were a sysadmin, that list was basically law.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
If a network card wasn't on the Microsoft HCL, you just didn't buy it, period.
You didn't buy it. But those lists are pretty much gone now for Windows 10 and 11.
Yeah, I've noticed I can't find a central Microsoft database for that anymore.
That's because they just stopped maintaining them. The ecosystem became too vast. So the burden of proof, it shifted. Now it's up to the hardware vendor to certify that their device works with Windows, not the other way around.
Wait a minute, doesn't that introduce a massive conflict of interest? I mean, if I'm a hardware vendor, wouldn't I just slap Windows compatible on the box and, hope for the best?
You would think so, and it does happen, but that's the nuance. If a device isn't on a vendor's specific list for a specific OS version, it doesn't mean it's broken.
Just means,
It just means it's untested. It's a gamble. The driver might work perfectly, or it might cause a blue screen of death every single time the system wakes from sleep.
So we've moved from certified by Microsoft to trust me, bro, from the manufacturer.
Essentially, yeah. And that leads us right into the system requirements themselves. There's a line in the research that I just love. It says Microsoft is nothing if not optimistic.
Which is a very polite way of saying they're delusional about how little RAM you actually need.
Precisely. We have to distinguish between minimum and recommended. Minimum specs are just the absolute floor. It's what's required for the kernel to load and the interface to render.
Yeah.
It doesn't guarantee usability.
Right.
The text uses the technical term oomph. You need enough overhead to actually run your applications, not just the OS.
Okay, let's look at the transition from Windows 10 to Windows 11, because that's where a lot of people are getting stuck right now.
Yeah.
The processor speed requirement, 1 gigahertz, it looks the same on paper,
Yeah.
but that's deceptive, isn't it?
Extremely deceptive. The clock speed hasn't changed, but the security architecture absolutely has. This is the biggest friction point in modern deployments. Windows 11 requires a trusted platform module, TPM 2.0,
Right.
and UEFI firmware with Secure Boot.
I feel like TPM just became a buzzword overnight when Windows 11 dropped. Why is this suddenly a hard requirement? Is it really just to force all of us to buy new PCs?
It feels that way, I get it, but there is a legitimate security reason. TPM isn't just a chip, it's a hardware-level vault. It stores encryption keys, passwords, certificates, all separate from the main processor.
So it's like a separate safe for the important stuff.
Exactly. With ransomware attacks getting so sophisticated, software-based security just isn't enough anymore. If the keys to your kingdom are stored in the same place as the malware, you lose. TPM puts them in that separate hardware safe.
So Windows 11 is essentially saying, if you don't have the safe, we're not letting you move into the house.
That's a good way to put it. And yeah, that stranded a lot of perfectly capable Intel and AMD chips that just happened to be a few years old. The other major shift is the architecture itself. Windows 11 is 64-bit only. The 32-bit version is, well, it's dead.
This is something I really want to drill into. We see x86 and x64 all the time. Most of us know x64 is better. But in an enterprise environment, why does this distinction actually cause installation failures?
It all comes down to addressable memory. In a 32-bit architecture, the system can mathematically only address 4 gigabytes of RAM. That's it. It doesn't matter if you physically install 32 gigs of expensive memory.
A 32-bit OS just can't see it.
It can't see it or use anything past that 4 GB ceiling.
It's like having a huge warehouse full of inventory, but your inventory list only has
4 lines on it. You can't see the rest.
Exactly.
And it gets worse because system hardware, like your video card, it reserves some of that address space for itself. So in a 32-bit system, you might only actually get 3.2 gigabytes of usable RAM.
Which today is nothing.
In a modern environment, running Teams, a browser, a database, it brings the system to a crawl. That's why the move to 64-bit isn't just about speed, it's about removing that artificial ceiling.
But there's a compatibility catch, right? A 64-bit OS can run 32-bit apps, but not the other way around.
Correct. It's a one-way street. A 64-bit OS is a large container that can hold smaller 32-bit boxes, but you can't stuff the big 64-bit box into the small 32-bit container.
Got it.
That's why if your hardware supports it, and almost all modern hardware does, you install the 64-bit OS. Otherwise, you are just voluntarily handicapping your infrastructure.
Speaking of handicapping your infrastructure, let's talk about the hidden requirements, the things that aren't on the main sticker. I'm thinking about prerequisites like .NET framework or specific SQL versions.
This is where deployments fail silently. You might have the RAM, you might have the CPU, but if an application requires .NET 3.5 specifically and you only have 4.8 installed, the installer will just stop.
Or worse.
Or worse, it tries to install an older version and corrupts the newer one. It's a mess.
And licensing adds a whole other layer of complexity. It's not just typing in a serial number anymore.
No. In the enterprise, you're dealing with node-locked licenses, which are tied to a MAC address, or network concurrent licenses, where a central server just counts how many people are using the app at once.
And if that license server goes down?
Nobody can launch the app, even if it's installed perfectly on their local machine.
Okay, there was a tip in the source material about pre-sales support that I thought was pretty clever.
Oh, the pre-sales hack. I love this one. So basically, vendors always understate the requirements because they don't want to scare you off.
Right. Makes sense.
The tip is don't trust the data sheet. Call the pre-sales engineer and tell them your actual workload. I have 50 users hitting this database concurrently. They will usually tell you, oh, for that, you need double the RAM we listed on the website.
Better to find that out on a phone call than on launch day.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's shift to the how, the actual installation methods. We can skip the history of DVDs. We all know they're obsolete. But the replacement, the ISO file, isn't as straightforward as people think, especially with modern Windows.
Right. Everyone knows how to mount an ISO or, you know, burn it to a USB stick.
Mm-hmm.
But here is the gotcha that catches even seasoned pros.
Okay.
To boot a modern computer in UEFI mode, which you need for that secure Windows 11 install we talked about, the USB drive usually needs to be formatted as FAT32.
Okay, that's a standard format. What's the problem?
The problem is that FAT32 has a hard file size limit of 4 gigabytes. If you try to copy a file larger than 4 GB, it just fails. And the main installation file inside a modern Windows ISO, the install.wim file.
Let me guess, it's bigger than 4 gigs now.
It's often 5 gigabytes or larger now.
So you have a file system that physically cannot hold the file you need to install the OS.
Mm.
That's a catch-22.
It is. You can't use NTFS because some UEFI BIOSes won't boot from it. You can't use FAT32 because the file is too big. So you have to use command line tools like DISM to split that massive .wim file into smaller chunks, into .swm files that will actually fit on the drive.
Wow. That is a perfect example of why this isn't just click next. You actually have to engineer the installation media itself.
Exactly. And that's just for one computer. When you're managing a 500 or 5,000 endpoints, you are not walking around with a USB stick.
No, you're using enterprise methods.
Yeah.
This gets us to the push versus pull debate. The text mentions MECM, formerly SECM, versus group policy. I think people often see these as just two ways to do the same thing, but the control difference is massive.
It's a huge difference. Let's look at push first, which is typically MECM, Microsoft Endpoint Configuration Manager. The source calls this the Swiss Army knife, but I kind of prefer thinking of it as a command center.
Okay, a command center, why?
The key differentiator is the agent.
the little piece of software installed on the client machine.
Right. That agent is constantly reporting back to the server. It's telling the management point, I have this much disk space, this patch level, this software installed. Because of that, the admin can target installations with surgical precision. You can say, push this update only to machines that have Adobe Reader version 9 and at least 2 gigs of free space.
And you get confirmation that it actually happened.
That's the critical part, compliance reporting. You know exactly who succeeded and, more importantly, who failed.
Okay, now contrast that with pull, which is usually group policy.
Group policy is more like leaving a memo on the company bulletin board. You set a policy in Active Directory that says, when you log in, install this MSI file. The computer boots up, reads the policy, and then tries to pull the file from the network share.
But there's no agent reporting back.
Not really. It's pretty much fire and forget. You don't easily know if it worked unless a user calls the help desk saying their app is missing. It's simpler to set up. There's less infrastructure. But for complex deployments, you're flying blind.
There's also a massive network impact here that the text really highlighted. If I decide to push a 5GB Office installer to 500 machines at 9:00 a.m. on Monday, what happens?
You basically create a denial of service attack on your own company. If 500 machines try to pull 5 gigs simultaneously, you just flood the switches. This is where advanced features like multicast come in.
Multicast. Break that down for me.
So standard traffic is unicast one-to-one. The server sends the file 500 separate times, once to each PC. That's a lot of traffic. Multicast is one-to-many. The server sends the packets once, and all the listening PCs on that network segment catch them at the same time.
So it's the difference between sending 500 individual emails or just shouting the message once in a crowded room.
And making sure everyone can hear you. It's way more efficient, but if your network switches aren't configured for it, it just won't work.
This brings us to the broader topic of impact. We aren't just installing software. We are modifying a live production environment. The source breaks this down into device, network, operations, and business. And I feel like these are often handled by different departments who don't even talk to each other.
And that's where the concept of a standard operating environment, or an SOE, comes in. You build an SOE to standardize these variables so you can predict the impact. Take the device impact storage is the classic anxiety.
The Goldilocks dilemma.
Right. Allocate too much partition space, you waste expensive storage. Allocate too little, and the app crashes when the logs fill up. But looking at the network impact is where things get really dangerous. The text uses the example of an NVR, a network video recorder.
Security cameras.
Yeah, and people treat them like webcams. But a high-def camera is a constant, unceasing stream of data. If you install a video surveillance system and route that traffic over your corporate WAN without calculating the bandwidth,
you're in trouble.
You will choke out critical business traffic. Email stops, VoIP phones start to jitter, everything slows down because the cameras are just eating the pipe.
And that leads directly to business impact. The example in the text was about a point of sale system, a POS system.
This is all about operational stability. A POS terminal has one job, take money. If you decide to treat it like a generic PC and install a heavy antivirus scan scheduled for noon or a background office update, and that register freezes while a customer is waiting,
you've just cost the business real money.
Exactly. Technical correctness does not equal operational success. Just because the software can run on the hardware doesn't mean it should run during business hours.
And finally, we have to talk about security. We touched on TPM, but the software itself is so often the weak link.
It really is. We spend millions on firewalls, but then we install a third-party application with sloppy code that opens a port and just sits there listening for connections. That's a backdoor.
The text mentions that because of this, and because developers know their code isn't perfect, we're seeing a big shift toward self-updating applications.
It's the Chrome and Zoom model, you know? The application checks the vendor server every time it launches and updates itself in the background. From a security standpoint, this is good. It patches vulnerabilities quickly.
But from a control standpoint?
It's a nightmare.
That's the tension, isn't it?
Right.
As an administrator, you want a frozen, predictable state. But the software is now designed to be a moving target.
Right. If an app updates itself and changes a feature, or worse, breaks a workflow, you didn't approve that change. It just happened. You're responsible for the network, but you're not fully in control of what's running on it anymore.
And sometimes the only answer is just containment.
Firewalling. If an app needs to be on the network, but you can't trust its security hygiene, you isolate it. You block its ability to talk to the core servers. You basically treat it like a guest on your own network.
So to recap this whole thing, We've gone from the disappearance of the Microsoft HCL to the hardware-level encryption of TPM. We navigated the FAT32 limits of USB installers, and we weighed the efficiency of multicast against the chaos of unicast.
And we realized that installing is actually integrating. It's all about ensuring that adding something new doesn't break what's already there.
It really seems like the days of set it and forget it are long, long gone.
Oh, they are. The environment is just too dynamic now.
I want to leave you with a final thought based on that self-updating trend we just discussed. The source material hints at this shift where software maintains itself. So if we are moving toward a world where applications patch their own holes and change their own code without administrator intervention, at what point does the IT department stop being the administrator and just become the observer?
That is the question that keeps CIOs up at night.
Something to think about the next time you see that update ready notification pop up. Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
See you next time.